Today on Rockin' the Suburbs.
Hey, Patrick. Apparently, Scott didn't get one of the albums you promised him.
That's true. I can't abide a scratch.
So, Patrick.
Yes, Jim.
Recently.
Yes.
You and I went record shopping.
We did. That was a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm. A lot of fun. There's some video evidence of it that we're putting up on our social medias. You'll be able to see that.
Yep.
And also, there's some video evidence of one of the recipients of said record.
So great.
Binge. Mm-hmm. And he's going to be joining us in just a minute.
Great.
This is Rockin' the Suburbs. I'm Jim Lenihan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
And with us today also is...
Intern Sam.
Intern Sam Lisker.
Hey,
Sam. Howdy.
And I mentioned we have a caller today, and we like to feature some of our patrons of the show, the folks who contribute to the show on patreon.com/suburbspod at a certain level where they get guaranteed guest appearances and they get to pick the topic. And we have one of those people today. And also, he is such a great patron of the show that we went record shopping for him recently and sent him some records. So if you get in at a really good level, we'll do that for you. And
good,
then I mentioned that he also sent us a video, an unboxing.
I know. It was
video
so great.
So anyway, just
watched it this morning. It was so cool.
So welcome to the show, Scott Parks.
Hey, how's it going, everybody?
Good, Scott. Thanks.
Appreciate those records. That was a surprise. I figured you guys would pick some good stuff, but I was not expecting that, especially things that I literally had never heard of before, and I'm super excited to get some of those on the turntable.
Fantastic.
Okay, so before we get to the topic that Scott wants to talk about, why don't you guys want to talk records at all?
Well,
Patrick did. I'll tell you guys, we went record store shopping for two patrons on the same day, and I kind of took one and you took the other. So this stuff you got, Scott, is Patrick's picks.
Yeah,
I kind of felt that a little bit, to be honest with you. I don't know exactly why, but I think it was that La Vie en Rose, the New Rose compilation, that kind of had Patrick written all over
it. Yeah, that's an obscure favorite of mine, and it's got a replacements track sort of hidden on there, but it's also sweet. Two albums, pink vinyl. So, Scott, if you notice on the video we made at the record store, there's one record that didn't actually make its way to you, and a different record did. And I'll tell you the reason why. When I got home, I examined the record a little more closely, and it was definitely not up to acceptable condition. It had a big scratch on one side of it, and I didn't notice that in the record store. So
I
made a switch out to another one and ended up sending something that I think Scott's going to really like, a band called That Petrol Emotion, which features members of the Undertones. So this was another band they have after they left the Undertones.
Oh, interesting. So,
I think you're going to like that one, Scott. It's heavy on guitars and really cool songs. So
yeah, I actually looked that band up after after opening that box, and I'm really excited about that one. I'm also really excited about True Believers.
Yes.
Been a fan of Alejandro Escovedo, but I'd never listened to this band. I didn't even know it existed.
Oh,
so,
wow. I think you're going to love them. There's some really cool songs on that record.
So what was the record Scott didn't get?
Well, Adrian Belew, Lone Rhino, was a record that we purchased, but again, when I got home, I was like, I can't send this. It's, you know, it's got a scratch, and that's not cool. So I went up and found another one a couple days later, and I found a gem, so I was real happy with that one.
Very
Very
nice.
So it actually worked out better, I think.
I appreciate it, guys. That was awesome.
Okay, cool. Well, we appreciate your support.
Yes, we do.
So as I mentioned, another benefit to being a patron of the show is you can pick the show topic.
I know.
We have you on. You can pick the show topic. Once every 3 months, you're going to get this deal, as long as you keep up your end of the deal. And so so what are we going to talk about today, Scott?
Well, one of my favorite show types or shows that you guys do is Patrick's Book Nook. So I figured I would co-opt that idea and have an episode called Scott's Book Spot.
Nice.
We're going to cover the book Jason Molina, Riding with a Ghost by Aaron Osman.
Okay.
I've talked about Molina on this show many times. Most of the calls and stuff that I've spoken about is either Molina direct or has some relation to Molina. And figure this would be a good time to get Jason out to the rest of your subscribers and and listeners and get some of his music out there. I don't think he's as well known as he should be.
All
so
right.
So figure we cover the book and kind of some of his music and his life.
Have you read this book, Patrick?
I have read it, and I think it's fantastic.
Okay. Great.
I really do. I think it's a great book. And I don't know, Scott, it's, as far as I'm aware, it's the only one about him that's out there at all. And, you know,
there's limited stuff about Molina.
Yeah, there really is.
There's a lot of YouTube videos. You can find a lot of live YouTube videos mm-hmm. from house shows, from, you know, shows that he played throughout his career at small clubs. But when it comes to actual writings about Molina, there's really not a whole lot.
Right.
This book was written by Erin Osman. She had reviewed some of his records for Pitchfork back in the day. Mm-hmm. She toured around with him for periods of time and was kind of a good friend of his, I believe, in his time in Chicago.
Yeah.
And so she had an inside track with a lot of his friends and was able to get all the people that really knew him on board to make this book. So it's not a happy story by any means.
No.
Definitely takes a turn for the worse near the end. So, I figured what better topic to pick on a nice summer day than something that's going to bring everybody down. But he was a genius, in my opinion, and I think he's an artist that everybody needs to know.
So, for people who don't know, what do you think people need to know?
He's born in Northern Ohio, which I know you were born in Northern Ohio, Jim.
Yep.
He was born in Lorain, Ohio, on the banks of Lake Erie. Mm-hmm.
The Cleveland area.
Yeah, exactly. I think it was 45 minutes from Cleveland or so. And he was a big Indians fan. I know in the book they talk about as a child, he would listen to the Indians games. He had a really great interest in Civil War and collecting historical relics. And a lot of the songs in his early albums actually kind of talk about that. He didn't really have a great childhood growing up. His father was a school teacher. He I think he had a good relationship with his dad, but his mother was an alcoholic, which actually plays a role in his life going on.
Wow.
Because his father was a school teacher, he actually had summers off, so they'd spend a lot of time in West Virginia, which is where his father was from. And again, some of his early writings have a lot to do with West Virginia, as well as, again, Civil War and those types of things. Did you get anything else out about that early part of the book, Patrick, when you read that?
Yeah, and I think that's really well summarized, Scott. The only thing I'll add is that it's interesting to me that throughout his life, Jason Molina would collect objects that he thought were really interesting, and I think that started when he traveled to West Virginia and he spent time like roaming around the banks of Lake Erie and finding things. But he would collect them and almost carry these objects around and attach a lot of significance to these things he carried around, and sometimes it would be like collections of objects. It was really interesting, I thought.
Yeah, exactly. He, from what I understand, he had a lot of stuff that he would just carry around with him in cigar boxes and little trinkets wrapped in banners and flags from the Civil War era. So, he kind of did that throughout his entire life. Even later on in life, once he met his wife, he would attach meaning to what some people would consider meaningless things and just carry those around with him for the rest of his life.
Yeah, it's fascinating.
So, after his young childhood, he went into high school, and he had always been a big music fan from his father's record collection, and he started getting into heavy metal. So he had a few heavy metal bands in high school, probably the most notable, the Spine Riders. They had won a local Battle of the Bands when he was in high school. Ended up kind of wanting to change his genre and started getting a little bit more interested in punk and indie folk and things like Lou Barlow's Sebado. So he kind of broke off from Spine Riders and started recording under a name called Bleem, B-L-E-E-M. Fall of 92, goes to Oberlin College, which is a nearby town, and little did I know until I read the book that Oberlin's actually has a bunch of famous musicians that went there. The band Codeine, slowcore band Codeine, they were based in Oberlin. Liz Phair was a graduate of Oberlin.
Yep.
And then after Molina was there, two-thirds of the Yeah Yeah Yeahs, Karen O and Brian Chase, both graduated from Oberlin. So at Oberlin, he recorded under the Bleem name, and eventually became familiar with Bonnie Prince Billy. Actually, it's his previous band, which was called Palace Brothers. Kind of got really involved with getting obsessed with those records, and actually ended up sending Will Oldham a tape. And Will Oldham actually allowed, or wanted him to record a single. So his first release was actually from Palace Records, the Drag City imprint that Will Oldham had. It was two songs. Songs were called Soul and Freedom Part 2, and the single was called Nor Cease Thou Never. Originally, he actually recorded these songs under the name Sparky. Will Oldham said, I don't think that's a good idea for you to release that under the name Sparky. So he actually said, why don't you release it under the name that you had on the tape? And the name on the tape was Songs Ohio. Songs colon H-O-H-I-A, Songs Ohio. I guess he had a penchant for just labeling tapes songs and then a colon and then the place or something else that related to where he recorded them. So that's how he became Songs Ohio.
Is there a song we should listen to now?
Well, I would recommend let's listen to one of the songs from his first full-length record. This was after he had signed with Secretly Canadian, which is, again, maybe a label you're familiar with, Jim. It's based in Bloomington.
Yep.
Swanson Brothers, they actually heard that Palace single and became enamored with him, ended up contacting him. And he basically made them drive 800 miles to watch him perform before he would allow them to listen to any additional songs. So they drove 800 miles straight, didn't stop, saw him perform. They released his second single on Secretly Canadian, and then in 1997 released his full-length debut, just titled Songs Ohio. So I think we should play either Old Republic or UMW Pension. I think Old Republic's maybe a little bit better of a beginning for people that aren't familiar with Songs Ohio.
Okay, here we go.
Yeah, beautiful tune. I think you can hear the influence of Palace and Lou Barlow's early Sebado work in that song. But at the heart of it, it's Jason's unique lyrics and his voice. His voice really has something different and distinctive about it. God, and that's one of the things that's always attracted me to his music, along with his just unique vision of the world.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, his voice, it just cuts to your soul. There's something about it. First time I ever heard it, I was completely obsessed from that point forward. You know, I didn't know about him early on, and we can kind of get to that a little bit later. But yeah, I agree. His voice and that tenor guitar that he used to play back in the early days, his voice and that tenor guitar mix, there's just something really special about it.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a certain feeling he gives the music it's like he's like living the music.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. It seems to pour out of his soul. Right. It seems to like it's always have been there and he's just sort of finding it, you know, and getting it outside of himself. So yeah, that's well said. He is an incredibly singular artist. And as Scott hinted at, that's one of the things that makes his story so tragic when it begins to unfold.
Yeah. So let's continue with the story.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he releases that album in 97 and actually moves to Bloomington from Oberlin after he graduated and lives in the Swanson Brothers basement. Had nowhere else to go. And they said, yeah, come on in. It'll live our basement. Played some shows there supporting the Black Album. Ended up getting a couple jobs there. You may know of maybe the places CD Exchange and Roscoe's Cafe in Bloomington. He worked at both of those places. Yeah. November 97, he actually met Darcy Shaneman, who would eventually become his wife. They quickly became a couple, and within months he basically became completely obsessed with her and started writing songs about her. He released an album in 98 called Impala, a couple of EPs. He really didn't come into his own, I don't think, though, until around 99. He released an album called Axis and Ace in 1999. It was a major development in the maturity of his songwriting and his singing. Basically, it's an entire album of love songs written for Darcy. He followed that up in 2000 with The Lioness, another complete album full of love songs for Darcy. There's two songs between those that I think might be the greatest love songs ever written. You would never expect them to be love songs based on listening to them, but if you really look deep into the lyrics and you know part of the story, you can really kind of see it and hear it. That would be Captain Badass from Axis and Ace, and then the title track, The Lioness, from The Lioness in 2000. So I would you know, want to listen to either one of those, probably Captain Badass. Lioness is really good, but Captain Badass, there's something special. The bass line in that album, it just kills me.
Okay.
So I don't know if you want to play that song.
Here we go.
And I think Scott said it really well, that those two albums really do mark a transition and maturity in his songwriting and vision and just a leap to what you may not have thought was possible or was coming from listening to his earlier work, which is more sparse and, you know, not quite as fleshed out. But you can really begin to hear the full flowering of his work in these two albums.
Well, and, you know, he was known to not even have the same band members.
Yeah.
He basically would have a different band almost every record, with the people that they thought were in his band not even realizing he was recording another album with somebody else.
Yeah.
The Lioness in 2000, he actually recorded with members of Arab Strap in Scotland. And the guys that he'd been playing with for years, they had no idea he was even recording an album. And he kind of did that for a good portion of his career. So, you know, following those two records, he ended up moving to Chicago. He and Darcy, they were still just dating at that point, moved to Chicago. And while in Chicago, this is really where he kind of took even another turn for the better when it comes to the quality of song production and songwriting. Late 2000, he released Ghost Tropic, which is just a haunting record.
Yep.
It's not one I would recommend listening to until you kind of get used to listening to his music, but it is unbelievable. Turn your lights off, put that record on, and just not do anything and just listen to it. It's crazy.
Yeah.
He followed that up in 02 with what most people consider to be his first perfect record, and that's Didn't It Rain, recorded live in the studio, no overdubs, and every single song is either a first or a second take.
Yeah.
Recorded this with people he'd never recorded with before. You'll listen to the song Didn't It Rain. At the near the end of the song, he actually says, let's do one more chorus. They didn't even know that was happening. He just basically on the fly said, hey, let's just do one more time. And he always liked to leave the warts and all the imperfections in his songs. He wanted it to be real, wanted it to be true. So 2002's Didn't It Rain, again, most people consider it to be his first perfect album. A little less than a year later, he released what I consider to be his magnum opus, what almost everybody considers to be his true masterpiece, and that's the Steve Albini produced Magnolia Electric Company album. Mm. It's the one that, even if you don't know Jason Molina's music, you know this record just by the iconic cover art by William Schaff with the picture of the owl. It's black and blue. I mean, it's a beautiful, beautiful piece of work, mm-hmm. beautiful piece of art. The entire record out cover and inside artwork is just amazing. It contains his most well-known songs, Farewell Transmission and Hold On Magnolia. There is one from this, though, that I would like to play, and it's actually where Aaron Osmond got the title of her book, and it's called I've Been Riding with the Ghost. Jason Molina actually saw ghosts and spirits throughout his childhood and actually truly believed them. This song kind of talks about, you know, not really having control of his life, and this is kind of where things started taking a turn for the worst when it comes to his alcoholism and what would eventually take his life. So if we could play I've Been Riding with a Ghost from Magnolia Electric Company, that would be great.
I've been riding with the ghost. I've been doing whatever he told me. I've been looking door to door to see if there was someone who'd hold me. Never met a single one who didn't see through me. None of them would love me if they thought they might lose me unless I made a change.
I think that Jason shared a quality, like Scott was talking about there, the way he wanted to keep sort of the honesty and the freshness when he recorded his music. He shared that quality with Bob Dylan. That was something that Bob Dylan, you know, often did. He wanted to do the takes, the first or second one, if he could possibly get that. And if he didn't, Bob Dylan would just change the lyrics so the song would become like more fresh. But I think that's obviously an amazingly high compliment for any songwriter, but to have that sort of gift, I feel, in Jason's music as well.
It's funny you mentioned Dylan, because I was almost hesitant to compare him to Bob Dylan, just because people will automatically be like, no one compares to Bob Dylan, right? But there is a similarity going back to what I was saying about the feeling. Mm-hmm. There's just a feeling in his music that I think feels so pure and so singular and so just honest that many artists don't have.
That's right.
And that was exactly the same thing with Dylan. Like, there were tons of folk artists at that time in that scene, but when he would get up and play, I mean, part was the quality of his songs, but part of it was just how he could deliver the
work. Yeah. That no matter how much you practice or how long you're in a studio, you'll never be able to capture it.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, Jason, actually, he was a workman. He actually was known throughout his career to treat this like a job. Yeah. He would sit there for 8 hours every day on days he wasn't doing something and just write songs. It's really something that's hard to describe. And I do think that the comparison to Dylan is right. And it just feels real. It just feels right. Like this is what he was meant to do. So following this record, he actually moved back to Bloomington. So, you know, you kind of notice there's a lot of movement in his life, leaving friends, you know, making new friends, going back to old friends, moved back to Bloomington, and on the tour for the Magnolia Electric Company, he mysteriously decided to change his moniker from Songs Ohio to Magnolia Electric Company. So, secretly Canadian, they still say that Magnolia Electric Company was the last Songs Ohio record. He claimed that it was the first Magnolia Electric Company record. So, who really knows? But nobody that it was actually in Magnolia Electric Company, the band, played on the Miko record. So, I would kind of side with secretly Canadian. He did actually recruit some guys that he knew in Bloomington. There was a band called the Coke Dares. Three guys from Bloomington that played together. He actually met them in 02 for the first time in a band called the Cinnamon Girls. They were a Neil Young cover band. First time he met them, they were playing Tonight's the Night in its entirety. And he, you know, became friends with them because he was a big Neil Young fan. So he recruits these guys. He recruited a couple of people that he knew and forms Magnolia Electric Company tours and basically just records music from about end of 03 through 09 with the same group of musicians, which was the longest that he'd ever really recorded with the same group of people. So he didn't have that rotating cast of members. His sound dramatically changed. It came closer to the Magnolia Electric Company sound, where it's more of a full band, more of a alternative country rock combination. There's a lot of comparisons to Neil Young and Crazy Horse in some of their music, especially on their first release. He actually has three or four parts of Neil Young songs in Magnolia Electric Company's first record that are just kind of woven into his songs. You know, that's what he did. He kind of recorded with them. In 08, he did actually record an album with Centromatic's Will Johnson. Mm-hmm. They recorded an album called Molina and Johnson. They actually had planned a tour, but at this point, that's when, again, things started getting really rough. On the tours with Magnolia Electric Company, he had started drinking a lot. They had to, you know, go to the lengths of trying to find his hidden bottles and hide them or drink them or do whatever they could so he actually, you know, would be able to play the show. Most of the time they were successful. The shows that they could keep him from drinking too much were miraculous and were amazing. The ones they couldn't, I've heard some pretty disastrous shows a la The Replacements, but not in a fun way. Not that The Replacements were fun, but this was more of a sadness because the people that were playing with him knew how special he was and what he could actually do on a given night.
No, that's well said. And it is, that's the part where it just gets tragic, you know, because he would still be able to show those glimpses of genius and beauty, but was clearly in the grip of something that was in his DNA, a disease, a very serious disease that eventually killed him that he couldn't control. And it's interesting for some people that struggle with alcoholism. It doesn't make you happy, but you're compelled to do it. And that seems like what it was with Jason. You know, it drove him to a terrible, dark place, yet somehow he continued to go there over and over and over again. So,
exactly.
Yeah, just really awful.
So in 09, he released his last major release called Josephine with Magnolia Electric Company. And if we could play one more song, that'd be great.
Sure.
It's a song called Whippoorwill. It was actually a song that he recorded for the Magnolia Electric Company album, but was never released. It did end up getting released on the 10th anniversary edition. The Josephine version is quite a bit different than the version that was released for Magnolia Electric Company. So I really like this song a lot. It's one that I kind of go back to quite often when I'm thinking about Jason. So yeah, I you know, think that'd be a great one to play. I think people would like it.
Okay.
All right.
Got my window open in the Southern Cross Hotel. It's been my longest night, I can tell. By the way, I'm not surprised to see the desert cover over Paris.
Heartbreaking.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
It is. Okay.
Yeah, so, you know, that's the final major release. He had a couple of other little things that were very limited release, but that was his final major release. In 2010, he moved back to Indianapolis after many, many, many attempts at cleaning up. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, he succumbed to his illness on March 16th, 2013, at the age of 39. That's actually when I found out about Jason Molina.
Okay.
I didn't know his music.
Wow.
Before that. I lived within 2 hours of him for the majority of his career.
Wow.
And I could have seen him many, many times. I live near Chicago right now. I lived in Indianapolis for several years while he was in Bloomington.
Wow.
And I kicked myself almost on a daily basis thinking that if I only found out about him earlier, I could have, you know, experienced seeing him live and being in the same room. But yeah, I found out about it from a Pitchfork. They actually posted Secretly Canadian's memo.
Mm-hmm.
That they wrote for his passing. And I saw Indianapolis and musician that's in Indianapolis that Pitchfork's talking about, and you know, immediately started looking into it, and I just couldn't believe it. So
yeah.
All I have to say is rest in power, Jason. Keep your trims your lamps trimmed and burning. That's something that he used to tell people, and I just hope more people will get to know the genius that is Jason Molina.
Well, and that is the beauty of music. It lives on.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So
yeah,
that's right.
Let's turn real quickly here to Sam.
I'd love to
anything yet.
Hear his reactions.
Is this your introduction to Jason Molina's work for
this
the most
is,
part?
I know we've played his work on the show before. We played it in episode, I think, like 65, and then another one between 230 and 240. I'm blanking on it. I was looking at when we played his songs. I hadn't really dived into his work until learning about this book that Scott was just talking about, and it's really a shame, you know, gone too soon. This mm-hmm. was a guy that was clearly very talented, but had some demons that he just could not
mm-hmm.
battle, and it eventually killed him, which really is just tragic. So turning back to the book, Scott, was there anything in it that really stuck out to you, that surprised you, or that built on something that you already knew about him that you didn't know about him?
I think maybe the relationship between he and his wife, you know, until I read that book, there's only, again, so much that was written about him throughout his career. And it just that relationship between his wife, especially as they were dating, that kind of really touched me. And then the Love and Work, my number one release from last year that I talked to you guys about, she actually had written an inscription on the inside, or a little thing. And again, it's just heartbreaking because they loved each other so much, and he just could not overcome the illness that he had. So
yeah.
I think that was it. Just reading more about their relationship and their love, and where these songs came from, because a good portion of the songs that he wrote were about her. And you can really feel it when you're listening to these songs.
Yeah, and feeling that connection is so important in music and just in the entertainment industry in general. That's just something you just don't see. Couples that just love each other that much in entertainment, there's always some ego battle going on. But in this, you can really feel that there was a spark, and it's just so tragic. Yep. But we really appreciate you coming on and talking about this book, because I'm definitely going to go listen to his music now after hearing about this.
Yeah.
And I hope others will too, Sam.
Absolutely.
I really do.
Me too.
It's a great work of scholarship and authorship. She did a fantastic job on this book. And like Scott was saying, I mean, Jason Molina was enormously talented. Like, listen to Whippoorwill. That's a song that Bob Dylan or Neil Young would be proud to have in their, you know, repertoire. Yet he was still playing very small places. I mean, I saw him one time with Magnolia Electric Company at the Black Cat, and it was about half full. You know, there was maybe 250 people there max, and that's about where, you know, they were, except for in certain towns and cities. He was pretty popular in Europe, but it's not like he was playing, you know, 5,000 seat theaters or anything like that. He was still a fairly small artist.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, he's playing the Hideout in Chicago, which is basically just a dive bar.
Yeah.
He was playing that all the way up until 2009.
Right.
So he couldn't even, you know, come close to playing any large venue at all. I know he did play Pitchfork Festival the first year they had it, but at that point, it was probably only several hundred people as well versus the larger festival that it has turned out to be.
Yeah.
So.
Well, this has been great. So thank you very much.
Yeah. Scott, I think, may have done a better job than Patrick does on his book.
I doubt that. I seriously doubt that.
I don't know.
But, yeah, and if, you know, if you guys want to play out song, there's one song that if you wanted to play out with, I think it kind of puts a nice ending to everything. It's the last track on Magnolia Electric Company. It's called Hold On Magnolia. Probably one of his more well-known songs, and it's beautiful. I could probably listen to that song for the rest of my life if I had nothing else that I could listen to.
Wow.
So, all right. We will do that. I also want to encourage listeners, if you want to comment on the works of Jason Molina, you can call and leave a message on our voicemail, 612-440-1984. Good job, Sam. Or you can email us rock@suburbspod.com, or you can hit us up on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all of those at Suburbs Pod. And if you want to be like Scott and be on the show on a regular basis like this and pick the topic, go to patreon.com/suburbspod, and all the information is there on how you can do that.
I'm so thrilled with the way this has worked out. I mean, these topics have been top shelf, and all of them have been such great shows.
Our listeners are so creative.
Oh my gosh,
this is
so
great. So you got 3 months to think of the next topic.
That's right.
No, I've already got several in mind.
Oh, all right. So excellent.
I'll keep on thinking though.
Awesome. All right, sounds good.
I'm thinking about the next box that's going to come.
There you go.
If that one will top this one.
Yeah, everybody should watch the videos. You get the shopping video and you get the unboxing video.
Yep. Yeah, that was so much fun.
So, great stuff. All right. Thanks very much. We got to run. We got more calls to make and so on and so forth. So, thanks very much, Scott. We'll talk.
Okay, thanks, guys.
We'll talk to you later.
Yep.
And to the listeners, we'll also talk to you later. It's Rock in the Suburbs. I'm Jim Linehan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
And I'm intern Sam.
And here is Hold On Magnolia.
The
dog finally gets a hold of me.
All right, Jim, you go first.
Okay.
And then, hold on.
So no, you go first. I go second. Mike goes
go
first.
Second. Mike, no, no. I go first.
Okay.
Mike goes second, and then Mike goes third.
I go second.
See that? No, I go first. You go second.
Okay, I go second. All right, go.
Then I go.
Okay, go for it.
Today I'm rocking the suburbs.
Hey, Patrick, apparently Scott didn't get one of the albums you promised him.
Patrick, are you okay?
I think so. Did you... discover a scratch.
What is happening here?
Hold on.
I think all I'm right. supposed to
I think
to
we
say
have it. Some problems here.
I think we need a copy editor.
User error.